This is the Epilogue Audio Experience. Hi guys, welcome to another episode of the SOS Show. I'm your host Suchita, and today we are going to scrap the surface of neuroscience. What does a neuroscientist do when it comes to mental illness? Which part of the brain gets affected when you have a bipolar or a schizophrenia? And what could possibly be the sudden reason of someone having a mental illness if they do not have a family history? What is the kind of research that's happening in mental illness? Is it enough? Why does Carl Jung's The Red Book have similarities when it comes to the hallucination aspect of mental illness like schizophrenia? And can a brain-computer interface be an answer to the future of mental illness? Please welcome our guest, Vidita Vaidya. Vidita is a professor in the Department of Biological Sciences at the Tata Institute of Fundamental Research. Her research group is interested in understanding the neurocircuitry of emotion. Vidita has a BSc in Life Science and Biochemistry and a PhD in Neuroscience from Yale University. And the work of her group was recognized by National Bioscientist Award 2012 and Shanti Swarup Bhatnagar Prize for Medical Sciences from the Government of India. She also received the Nature Excellence in Mentoring Award in the mid-career category in 2019. Hi Vidita, welcome to the SOS Show.
Hi Suchita.
You know, Vidita, I want to start this neuroscience. The term neuroscientist is a very, it looks like a very complex term. So for our audience, would you like to explain what does a neuroscientist do?
Okay, so a neuroscientist is usually someone who has a PhD and not an MD. So they're not necessarily, you know, the doctors that you standardly think about. The doctor you think about is somebody you go to get treated for a disease. So neuroscientists are scientists with PhDs who study the brain. And they do it in diverse ways. They would study it either in animal models, ranging from a worm to a fly to a mammal. And some neuroscientists, of course, also study the human brain. But more often than not, they are PhDs who are doing basic research, trying to understand how the brain works, how the brain functions. And every now and then you will have a neuroscientist who also has an MD. And has both an MD or a PhD and is also capable of treating patients. But that just gives you a broad idea of what neuroscientists are.
Sure. So when it comes to mental illness, Vidita, when you guys do the research, which part of the brain specifically gets affected? For example, when it comes to a bipolar or a schizophrenia or a depression, is it the neurons? Is it the synapses? Is it the cortex?
So this is it's a hard question to answer, Suchita. So let's say, you know, let's start with a simple thing. Let's say somebody is not feeling well and they think that something is not working in their brain, right? I mean, it could be that you have a movement disorder. You're not able to easily pick up a cup of coffee. You find, muscle tremors. So you go to a neurologist and a neurologist may diagnose you, for example, with a movement disorder or with Parkinson's disease. And then you ask this person, what part of my brain is not working? They will be able to answer you by saying it's your basal ganglia, which is a part of the brain that contains a part of the area of the brain that also produces dopamine and supplies the dopamine as a signal to those parts of your brain that control movement. Unlike that, let's say you start feeling really low, mood swings, you're not feeling well, and you decide that maybe you don't need a neurologist, but you need to go and speak to a psychiatrist. So you go to the psychiatrist and you say, can you tell me which part of my brain is not working normally? A psychiatrist will not be able to give you as straightforward an answer because it is more complex with disorders of mood and disorders of emotion. Multiple parts of the brain are involved. It's difficult to pinpoint any one part of the brain that is particularly involved. It's neurons not working, as a consequence, synapses not functioning, but in many parts of the brain and not just one particular part of the brain. So it's difficult to pinpoint a specific circuit. Like for diabetes, you would say maybe it's my pancreas that are not producing appropriate amount of insulin. It's much harder in the case of mental diseases to say it's your raphe, which is not producing enough serotonin, or it's another part of the brain that produces norepinephrine. unfortunately, with psychiatric disorders, it's many parts of the brain which are not optimally functioning. So unfortunately, I can't give you a categorical answer saying it's the cortex or the hippocampus, because it's likely to be many parts of the brain simultaneously not working at their most optimal state.
Sure. So, Abhijita, what could be possibly a reason for, a sudden dysfunction? For example, in the podcast, I've been asking a lot of people with bipolar or with schizophrenia or with depression. A few of them feel that it's because of the genes. They're taking it from their mother or from their father when it comes to bipolar. When it comes to schizophrenia, they do not know what could possibly have gone wrong, what could have happened. Similarly with depression. So is it that it can happen suddenly? The brain, some part of the brain can get affected. What's your analysis of it?
So it's true that sudden onset is usually, there are usually predisposing starters. You would have a hint that you're going down that road, and then it manifests as a full-fledged disease. It is true that there is a component of this disease that all the mental health disorders, all psychiatric disorders do have a component of genetic disposition. But it's not enough to simply say that I have it because of a genetic predisposition. Because if that was true, then identical twins who have the exact same genome, if one person gets schizophrenia, then the other person, the identical twin, should have also had schizophrenia. But that doesn't turn out to be the case in many, many instances. It increases your risk. So yes, there is definitely a risk component that comes from the genetic side, but there's a massive influence of environment, and environment and genes interact to decide whether someone eventually ends up with a disease or not. So it really is a combination of both a genetic predisposition and environmental changes. I hope that sort of at least gives you a broad sense. It's difficult to say what decides the onset exactly. There can also be big environmental factors like a major stressful event or a major event that actually precipitates a crisis. So that can also happen. But sometimes in the absence of any obvious environmental event, there can also be onset of psychiatric disorders.
So you're saying that it also is under the control of the person, how they deal with any form of crisis on a day-to-day basis more mindfully, and they can control their onslaught that
much. One thing I want to be very careful about is that your ability to cope is also directly determined by your brain, your brain circuits, your genetic background, and your prior environment. So to say that someone, two individuals, let's say two individuals go to war, okay? They both go to war. They both witness the most severe circumstances. Both of them come back. One develops post-traumatic stress disorder. The other doesn't. It would be difficult to say that, you should have dealt with it because this other person was capable of dealing with it. A lot of times our ability to cope and our ability to deal with a stressful event is directly determined by the way our brain allows us to cope and facilitates coping. Yes, there are definitely things we can do to make our ability to cope better. But there's no question that there is inherently already a variation in how two people may cope or handle a stress. And that is sometimes determined by their prior life history, sets of life circumstances, and their genetic background. So it's difficult to say that you should be able to deal with an event. Life circumstances may prevent you from being able to deal with an event, for example, and that may precipitate as a psychiatric state of mental health illness as well. The good news is it is possible to treat these diseases, and it is possible to recover. And the more we destigmatize them so that people admit and openly admit to the fact that most of us at some point or the other in our lives will go through a challenge which is difficult for us to cope with, the more we make it easier to ask for help.
Sure. Vidita, there has been massive research when it comes to mental health. There has been massive research when it comes to brain so far, since years.
Yes.
And in the podcast, all this while, I have got my friends who have mental illness, and also our guests on the podcast, they often complain that whatever medications they take, it has massive side effects. For example, yes, for bipolar, lithium can have a long-term kidney damage, and other medications like in schizophrenia, they become very sedative, they cannot move, they gain weight. So do you feel, as a neuroscientist, somewhere there is a lack in research, or we are not able to pinpoint exactly to give a 100% outcome?
Okay, so let's start by looking at the sort of last almost close to now 70 years. It was in the 1950s and early 1960s that the first round of potential medicines to even treat psychiatric disorder actually even showed up. Those medicines had horrendous side effects, several of them. With each generation of new drug being synthesized, it has gotten better. There's no question that there are better antidepressants today than the antidepressants that existed 40 years ago. They do have less side effects, but they still do have side effects. And that's not surprising because in many cases, many of these drugs elevate levels of specific neurotransmitters in the brain. But these neurotransmitters work on many, many receptors in the brain. And some of those actions you want, because those actions will help treat the patient and the disease. But some of those actions will also cause side effects. So, for example, having problems with digestion or with your gut or with libido is not uncommon because serotonin, for example, the neurotransmitter that is in a sense regulated by antidepressants, also regulates many, many other functions in your body. So it's very difficult to say that I only want the positive effects on mood and I want to remove every other effect on everything else. At least with the current treatments that are available, that is difficult to do. But with each generation of new medication coming, we're getting better and better at controlling and minimizing the side effects. Now, you mentioned lithium. Lithium has been used for a very long time. And unfortunately, there haven't been many other better treatments for bipolar disorder that have come up in the last several decades. And I want you to give you a sense that it's not because the research is not being done. It is being done actively all over the world. But the brain is a complex structure. And as yet, what we have in terms of treatments are things that reduce the symptoms or help with the symptoms, but they don't treat the primary cause of the disease or the primary circuit changes in the brain that might actually result in the disease. And the reason they don't do that is because we still don't understand exactly what structurally and functionally changes in the brain that results in the manifestation of symptoms and disease. So I would say to the broader public, that this is still something that the world over, neuroscientists, neurologists, psychiatrists are all trying to understand a brain function better to be able to design better drugs. But very often from understanding something to coming up with a treatment, it can take decades. So just to give you a sense, it's been only the last 70 years that mankind has truly attempted to actively generate large, types of different kinds of drugs to treat depression, anxiety, schizophrenia. And there have been major breakthroughs, but they're not enough. There's still much we need to do. There's still much we don't understand.
Science is one aspect of it. But if we go slightly outside science, for example, I was just going through Carl Jung's The Red Book. And when he went into altered state, he did this sketches and paintings. And when I actually, a few friends of mine who are artists and they have schizophrenia and they when they get into altered states, they draw very similar kind of drawing and painting. I was just trying to analyze. Has science ever sort of thought about another realm, another dimension that there could be when it comes to mental illness like schizophrenia, it could be beyond the neurons? It could be a spiritual thing?
So, eventually emotion, feeling, states of mind are thought, at least to the best of our understanding today, to be created by networks in your brain. So let's take an example of something like schizophrenia, because you raised that. When a person who has schizophrenia has a perception of a reality which is different from yours and mine. So for example, let's say you, me, and a person who has schizophrenia sitting in a room, and the two of us perceive the room in a particular way, and we will be able to share our perception, saying, oh, I see you sitting here, or I hear this. And the person with schizophrenia turns to you and say, but I also see this, and there's also sounds I hear which you are not hearing. You and I cannot immediately understand that because our shared perception is what we can tell each other, right? You and I can say, oh, I heard this. And you say, yeah, I also heard it. But if someone tells you, I heard something and you and I have never heard it, we are going to doubt whether this exists. Now, fundamentally, when that happens, it for the person who has schizophrenia, it does exist because the brain is what generates perception of your environment and your reality. Eventually, what you see is what your visual cortex or the part of your brain that is responsible for processing vision is really facilitating you seeing. So we only see in the visible spectrum. But for example, there are birds, there are insects that see in the ultraviolet range of the spectrum. And you and I cannot even perceive that. Now, would you say that doesn't exist? It does exist, but we just don't have the machinery to allow us to see it. Okay?
Sure.
So I think that that's where it becomes essential for science also to, in all disorders, when we stigmatize someone else's experience and say it is not reality because it is not your and my reality, it runs the risk of basically creating an isolation, a separation. This person is different. They are strange. They see things that don't exist. They imagine and hear things that don't exist. It creates a stigma. But fact of the matter is for them, in their brain, they are seeing it and they are hearing it. Okay?
Right.
Now, the way we probably tap into that is if anyone was to have a hallucinogenic drug, drugs like LSD, drugs like psilocybin, which is the main component of magic mushrooms, it is capable of producing a hallucinatory state in anybody. Even if you don't have schizophrenia and you take the medication, you do get an altered perceptual reality. It's because your brain processes that drug in a manner in which that it changes perceptual states in the brain. That is the closest experience we can have medically or at least clinically or just by giving a drug of perceiving realities that are not obviously out there, but in our mind, they're created.
Right.
Right. Now, the reason I'm bringing this up is very recently people have started talking about microdosing with some of these particular agents. Like LSD and psilocybin. And it's a tricky place because we still don't understand enough, but there's no question that there may be potential there for breakthrough therapies, which may come down the road. And, sometimes a sense of separation or altered perceptual reality has actually been beneficial. Sometimes it can be extremely harmful, but sometimes it has been deeply beneficial to the patient who then has a real breakthrough in treatment and actually may recover sometimes. So there's much to be known. I think that in the absence of really carefully studying it, it would be premature to say that these are ways via which one may be able to treat these diseases. But I think it's an area of active research and something I study in my own lab as well, that I believe needs the attention of the scientific community to really address whether altered perceptual realities may actually be a way by which sometimes even treatment modalities could tap into that to really bring about a change in state. Since you mentioned earlier, sorry, I'm just continuing from that idea, psychiatric disorders would benefit hugely by integrating practices from other disciplines, for example, sociology, anthropology, psychology, obviously. But exercise, for example, has a profoundly beneficial effect on mood. And if we incorporate that as a component of treatment, then we are benefited by it. We don't only have to think about treatments which are pharmacological or drug-based. Life interventional strategies, behavioral therapy have a profound effect on the brain as well. And that's not surprising because they are fundamental environmental changes, and environmental changes can impact the brain hugely. So I think incorporating strategies which involve broader than just psychotherapeutic drugs is a good idea, because we do have as much evidence that environment can also have a very profound effect on the brain.
Sure. And just adding this bit to the psychedelic drugs, this author, Tim Ferriss, has sort of given a huge, because he himself has written books on schizophrenia. I don't know if you're aware about that. He's given a huge amount of money for the research when it comes to psychedelic drugs and mental illness. So hopefully we can get a breakthrough in that space.
Yeah, but, and I mean, very recently, psilocybin microdosing was approved by the FDA. And it will be interesting to study some of these agents. They have been used in traditional shamanic treatments for centuries. So there might be something here that there is for us to learn. One of the compounds I use in my lab regularly is a potent potent regulator of altered perceptual reality. It's a 5-HT serotonin 2A receptor stimulator, and it does have an effect on mood. So it will be very interesting to see how these agents can actually change brain states and brain function fundamentally.
Sure. And what do you think about brain-computer interface? For example, Neuralink is the startup of Elon Musk. So do you think a brain-computer interface can, in the long run, benefit mental illness?
You know, I mean, let's put it this way. I would say that we are a very social species. Humans are a very social species, and our social environment is a profound regulator of our nervous system. I would say that the brain-computer interface place is more likely to initially come up with breakthroughs from the perspective of neurological disorders, which involve traumatic brain injury, Parkinson's, motor neuron disease, etc. Those are the places I see the first sort of applications. Given that psychiatric disorders deal with brain networks that are highly distributed, involve multiple circuits in the brain, and involve the communication between many circuits within the brain, I don't see this as the place where that initial breakthrough may come from. So I would say I'm guardedly optimistic on that front as far as psychiatric disorders are concerned, but certainly more optimistic as far as neurological diseases are concerned.
Mm-hmm. But tell me, according to you, being a neuroscientist, where do you see a lack in maybe understanding or research? Of course, there's a lot of research, a lot of understanding so far, but a specific area where that needs attention when it comes to mental illness.
So I work in particular, I'm going to give you my pet thoughts on this, obviously.
Yeah. Yeah.
I work on the early window of life, the first what's called a critical period in brain development, which happens soon after birth. And I do this, of course, in animal models. I work with rats and mice. But this is a window in which changes in environment, interactions with environment have a profound effect that is often lifelong. And I think we forget the critical importance of public health initiatives and also public policy. Because in many cases, the seeds of adult mental health dysfunction are sown very, very early. And they don't emerge till much later, decades later. But in early life, trauma in early life adversity is one of the common risk factors of all psychiatric disorders. So there is as much attention to be paid to prevention. Mm-hmm. And if one can look at the first decade and a half of human life and existence, the first 15 years, if one can buffer as much as possible nutritionally in terms of psychological states and well-being being a priority for a nation, then one has a fighting chance to reduce the risk for individuals. This is not to say that you will get rid of it, but certainly there is room for this. As much as there is room for research and treatment, there's also room for strategies to prevent and strategies to ameliorate and mitigate the scale of psychiatric disorders that we're seeing today. I mean, by 2020, the prediction was that it's going to be a major worldwide burgeoning crisis in psychiatric disease. And not surprising, and also currently given the major infectious disease assault that we're going through, social isolation, and that's why I prefer the term physical distancing, socially distancing. We are a social species. It's difficult to be socially distant. I mean, you can be physically distant from someone, but you do need the communication that is important for your own mental health.
Yeah.
And, now we have the technology to allow that. So I guess at some fundamental level, I hope that governments also think actively about the first 15 years of a child's life. And that can include starting from the very basics. So for developing countries, it would be nutrition, healthcare, basic access to, the basic requirements and fundamentals of human existence. If you provide that, the person has a fighting chance later.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel that there needs to be also as much focus on that, as much as there is on new research, new technology and new drugs being developed. But, if you prevent and you increase resilience, in a sense, and coping strategies, you will also have a profound effect in the long run.
Sure. And what do you think are the challenges that we're going to face now, henceforth, after COVID-19, in terms of mental illness?
I mean, I think it's a precipitating factor. You know, it's obviously a precipitating factor for anxiety. Individuals who have anxiety or who have obsessive compulsive disorder are going to face challenges during this period of time, because there is a huge component of uncertainty, and there's lack of clarity of how things are going to unfold and what will emerge. And that is a massive precipitating factor for individuals with OCD, anxiety, and also with individuals with depression, schizophrenia, other mental health challenges. This is a stressful time. It's a stressful time for most people. It's particularly stressful for those who are coping with mental health challenges at the same time. So I think we are, you know, we're going to see an increase in that for a period of time. And that's where it is going to be that equally important to also find ways to improve coping strategies during this period of time, making helplines available to those who have, you know, who are facing serious challenges, and to provide the support as well that needs to be provided during this period of time.
Sure. So increasing the helplines and providing support to people for the next couple of months, or perhaps ongoing from this time onwards. All right, Vidita Vaidya, thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure.
Your deep insight into mental illness.
Thank you, Suchita. Lovely talking to you.
Could psychedelic drugs be an answer to mental illness? Or can they open up a deeper understanding of mental illness? Author Tim Ferriss has donated $3 million for the research on psychedelic drugs and mental illness. Or a brain-computer interface could help us solve the mental health problems. Whatever it is, as Vidita said, the first 15 years of our life are the most important ones. That's where the parents, that's where the government needs to pay a very special attention to. So if there's something that you would like to share in terms of today's discussion, in terms of psychedelic drugs, in terms of your opinion on things, a personal story, you know where to find us. This is Suchita signing off.